Before I introduce the speaker, I'd just like to thank Billy and Rachel for all their hard work in making this workshop come together. Okay, it's my great pleasure to introduce Jennifer Lackey from Northwestern University, one of the eminent epistemologists of testimony of our times, and today she'll be speaking on religious belief and epistemology of testimony. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Donnie. And thanks to everyone, all the organizers, and to everyone at Oxford who has been, they've been such gracious hosts and, you know, such stimulating philosophical conversationalists. So what I want to talk about today is, religious belief in the epistemology of testimony. But what I'm interested in is, I think, a recent change in the climate in the epistemology of religious belief. So a couple of decades ago, most defenses of the justification of religious belief would look to model religious belief on perception. Okay, so we've got like the Bill Alstons and the Planning Us, and, you know, kind of those sorts of people who were really taking as the model perception and trying to argue that religious belief can fit this model. And recently, I think the tide has really been turning so that more and more people are interested in giving a justification of religious belief grounded purely in testimony. And so it's important that I emphasize what exactly I'm interested in. I'm interested in the approach that we can, in a way, bottom out in testimony in terms of the justification of religious belief. Okay? So these aren't like hybrid views, right? These aren't views that say, look, if you have like a perceptual experience of God, or you cultivate a particular relationship with God via prayer, and then you also have some testimonial experience that kind of guides you towards that, you can have justified religious belief. Okay? I'm interested in the approaches that people are recently taking that say, if your religious belief just bottoms out in testimony, that can be justified, okay? So the views that, a couple of recent people that I'm going to be engaging with specifically are John Greco and Linda Zagzebski. And I think it's not a coincidence that they're working within the same religious tradition, right? They're both interested in kind of justifying, they're both coming from the Catholic tradition. But really, they're both interested in justifying religious belief, either in just like the pure authority, the testimony from like a text, or the authority of a text. Okay, and what I'm interested in looking at are these attempts that say that we can actually do this by appealing to resources that are specific to the epistemology of testimony. Okay? And if we adopt certain views or have certain models or conceive of testimony in a particular way, we in a way get the justification of religious beliefs, you know, kind of for free. And I'm going to argue that that overall approach is really misguided. Okay? So one of the ways that I put this is that here's one of the slogans I have for the paper. We can't hide from doing philosophy of religion by seeking shelter in the epistemology of testimony. Okay? And what I mean by that is that if there's an objection to the rationality of religious belief, you have to engage with that objection on its own terms. There is no refuge to be sought in the epistemology of testimony. Okay? And along the way, I'm going to critique some particular arguments, but I don't think that any of the arguments I'm looking at are just so specific to the individual that they don't have general interest. Okay, so I'm going to look at some of John Greco's specific arguments, and I'm going to look at some of Linda Zagzebski's, and Linda Zagzebski's are grounded in the view of political authority developed by Joseph Raz. Okay, so I'm going to be looking at some of these particular arguments, but along the way, we're going to see some positive conclusions emerge, okay? And so one of the positive conclusions that I'm going to defend is on a very intuitive conception of authority, the conception of authority that we find in the work of Joseph Raz and in Zagzebski, there are no rationally justified beliefs on the basis of authority. Okay, so there are, that's going to be a conclusion I'm going to defend. There are no justified authority-based beliefs. And I'm also going to defend the view that we can't respond to certain objections that have to do with contingency or luck by appealing to, the mechanics of the epistemology of test use. So those are going to be some more general conclusions that are going to emerge from the specific arguments. Okay. So let's start. Okay, so the first challenge I want to look at is, so several of the objections that I'm going to be looking at, I might actually end up skipping, I've got a clock here. Okay. And did we start on time?
5 minutes.
5 minutes late? Okay. Okay, so I'll take those 5 minutes. And I've been instructed to speak for 45 minutes, is that right? Yes? Okay, so one of the first challenges that I want to look at is sometimes what's called the argument from luck, the argument from contingency, the argument from the accidentality of our birth. These are all kind of go under the same name. And I'm only going to look at a couple of the quotes because I want to keep within the time frame. So let's just look at the one quote on your handout from John Hick. So he writes, "Religious allegiance depends in the great majority of cases on the accident of birth. Someone born into a devout Muslim family in Pakistan is very likely to be a Muslim. Someone born into a devout Hindu family in India to be a Hindu. Someone born into a devout Christian family in Spain or Mexico to be a Catholic Christian, and so on." Now, as it stands, and we see this kind of, we find this kind of observation all over the place. But this is just a mere observation. It's just kind of pointing out that this is the case. But many people then work this observation into a skeptical argument about religious belief. Okay? So here's a passage from Philip Kitcher. He says, "Most Christians have adopted their doctrines much as polytheists and the ancestor worshippers have acquired theirs, through early teaching and socialization. Had the Christians been born among the Aboriginal Australians, they would believe in just the same ways, on just the same bases, and with just the same convictions, doctrines about dream time instead of about the resurrection. The symmetry is complete. Given that they are all on a par, we should trust none of them." And then we find Greco's kind of version, which I call the argument from luck, on your handout as well. So he says, "When one forms a true religious belief on the basis of testimony from within a tradition, it is just an accident or just a matter of luck. When one forms a true belief on the basis of this testimony rather than a false one on the basis of different testimony, knowledge can't tolerate this sort of luck or accident. And so true religious belief based on testimony from within a tradition can't count as knowledge." So premise one is just pointing out the observation that we see in the passages above. And premise two is just the widely accepted view that knowledge is incompatible with luck. Obviously, luck needs to be said about that. Lots of people have talked about that. Duncan Pritchard's written a whole book on luck. But we'll just kind of grant that. And three is just the skeptical conclusion that follows from one and two. So this is a familiar argument. Okay, as I said, we see this kind of argument. And many responses have been given. But like I said, recently in a series of papers, John Greco has attempted to kind of meet some of these challenges specifically via the resources of the epistemology of testimony. Okay, so here's what he says about this kind of argument. So he says, "On the present approach in the epistemology of testimony, and the approach he has in mind here is the approach according to which knowledge is transmitted via testimony." Okay. So he's saying, if we adopt a transmission model where if I know that P, I can transmit to you knowledge that P, then we may deny either premise one or premise two. Regarding premise one, we may deny that when one receives testimony from within a tradition, it's just an accident or just a matter of luck that one forms a true belief on the basis of that testimony. On the contrary, if the transaction in question constitutes an instance of knowledge transmission, it's underwritten by a reliable transmission of reliable information. That is, the transaction will involve knowledge on the part of the speaker, derived ultimately from some original source of knowledge, and then a reliable transmission of knowledge from speaker to hearer. Okay, so Greco says, look, once we understand the mechanics of testimony, and once we understand that it can be underwritten by just this reliable kind of process of transmission, then the argument of Locke, the argument from Locke just loses its bite, okay? Because if it is underwritten by this reliable process, then there just isn't knowledge depriving Locke. Now there are a few problems I want to raise with this. I'm not going to spend a ton of time on each one of these, because I'm going to spend most of the time on the well, how about this? I'm going to spend a disproportionate amount of time on them. Okay. So the first one is just that the mere fact that knowledge, testimonial knowledge, can be acquired via transmission doesn't say anything about whether or not there's knowledge in the first place, right? So, so Greco says that if the testimonial transaction in question constitutes an instance of knowledge transmission, it's underwritten by a reliable transmission of reliable information. But Greco can't assume that there's knowledge transmission in this in the transaction, since whether the speaker transmits knowledge to the hearer is precisely what's at issue. Okay? So it's just a very peculiar thing to be assuming, since one of the things we might, even if we grant a transmission model, and for some of you, you know that I've argued extensively against this, I'm not going to rehearse any of those arguments here, but I also wouldn't rest the defense of the rationality of religious belief on a view that's, you know, kind of contentious. But anyway, just granting the transmission view, one of the things that's at issue in this very in the very debate is whether or not the speaker can transmit knowledge to the hearer, even if testimonial knowledge is acquired via transmission. So it just seems like a peculiar thing to be assuming. But that's just a minor point. The second thing is that the mere fact that a process is reliable doesn't at all mean that it's incompatible with knowledge-depriving look. Okay, and I mean, I'm just going to, you know, kind of mention the most obvious is, I mean, we all know, you know, that this happens in Gettier cases, right? I mean, like the classic barn facade case, my perceptual faculty might in fact be highly reliable. Okay, I might form a reliable true belief, but there still is knowledge depriving luck or accidentality because of the presence of all of the barn facades nearby. Okay, so the mere fact that a process, you know, that is underwritten by a reliable process doesn't say anything about knowledge depriving luck. But I think the more interesting kind of luck that the proponents of the argument for luck are interested in is the kind of luck that attaches to the acquisition of a faculty. Okay, so not standard Gettier cases, but the cases where the process whereby we, you know, where we get the faculty in question, or, you know, the process, the belief-forming process in question, is itself a matter of luck. Okay? So we can imagine a case in which I fall down the stairs, and I bump my head, and I acquire a faculty where I'm able to tell what the weather is in Paris, reliably. Okay? Even if it is the case that I'm reliably forming true beliefs, the process whereby I got that faculty is itself just a matter of luck, okay? So we can notice this by saying that, like, obviously there are, you know, nearby possible worlds in which I fell down the same stairs, bumped my head, but didn't acquire, you know, the faculty whereby I formed this belief. So it looks like in such a case that I acquire the faculty, the process whereby I got it, is riddled with knowledge-depriving luck. Because I take it that most people wouldn't think that I know what the temperature is in Paris right now, merely on the basis of this reliable faculty. But the same thing can happen in testimony as well. So suppose that I know that the source of news that I rely upon is very likely to highly influence my beliefs. Okay, so I know that whatever news source I use, you know, I'm gonna form many of my beliefs about current events. Okay, just on the basis of hearing those reports. Now, suppose that I know that there are competing news sources. Okay, and that they offer pretty radically different beliefs. I mean, offer pretty radically different testimony. And so I would form competing beliefs. Okay, depending on which news source I chose. And I suppose that I decide to choose my news source simply on the basis of flipping a coin. Okay? I'm like, I just really have no idea. If it's heads, I'll go with NBC. If it's tails, I'll go with Fox. I don't know. And, you know, I, you know, comes up tails or whatever, comes up heads, and I end up relying on this news source. And as a result, end up with, we just might imagine, reliably formed true beliefs. The method, okay, the method itself, the process whereby I came to rely on that source, that testimonial source, is itself riddled with luck. Okay? And by analogy with the case of the bump on the head, in the cases of forming beliefs about the weather in Paris, it looks like it's also knowledge depriving luck. Okay. Now, this seems to be the kind of luck that's exactly what the proponent of the argument from luck has in mind, right? It's saying that religious beliefs that are formed on the basis of the testimony from like a religious community are very, very, very much like my relying on one of the news sources, okay? Except that I'm not flipping the coin in a way. There's just being a coin flipped, so to speak, right? There's no hand guiding me, okay, and saying, look, I'm gonna put Mikkel in this environment precisely so that he gets the right beliefs. But I'm gonna put Sandy somewhere else, you know what I mean? Just because I want him to form the wrong beliefs. Or it's not as though like you in the womb have a, you know, kind of can say, like, look, I'm gonna choose where, you know, what parents I'm gonna have, what community I'm gonna have, where I'm gonna be raised, and so on. Okay. It might turn out that some of us are right, and it might turn out that some of us are wrong, right? But how we ended up there, so says the proponent of the argument of luck, is very much like the coin toss, okay? That we ended up with those testimonial sources, okay, as being the ones that are giving us the information, you know, the relevant information, is very much like my relying on one news source over another through the coin flip, okay? So all of this is just by way of saying that even if you happen to be in a community in which you are, you know, kind of reliably forming true beliefs, that's not the end of the story, right? We also have, that's not the end of the story with respect to luck, okay? As Greco seems to be suggesting. We also need to ask how it is that you ended up in that community. And that's exactly, I think, what the proponent of the argument of luck is interested in. The third point I want to make is that that I think that there's another reading of the argument of luck that has to do with not in a way what the luck itself does. I mean, so on some, like, let's say, modal readings of luck, what's really going on, why it's knowledge depriving, is because, you know, it makes the beliefs unsafe, or, you know, it makes the beliefs insensitive or something like that, or, you know, there are other characterizations of luck. But what's going on, what's, you know, what the standard reading is that the luck kind of does something to, something happens to the belief as a result in terms of its relationship, either with the truth or the likelihood of its being truth or true or something like that. But I think there's also a reading of the argument of luck that has to do much more with our rational retention of the beliefs, okay, in the face of luck considerations. Okay, so in the face of considerations like the ones that I've been pushing about the coin toss. I'm going to kind of use some language. I'm going to use just the language of defeat. So I'm not going to kind of you know, defend this here. I've talked about it elsewhere, but I'm just going to assume for the purposes here. I don't think this is a highly contentious assumption at all, that knowledge is incompatible with undefeated defeaters. I mean, I know that some people have challenged this in a limited sort of way, I think. I mean, I don't think it's a general kind of argument. I think it's a more limited argument. But I'm going to talk about what I call doxastic defeaters and normative defeaters. So just very roughly, doxastic defeaters would be counter beliefs that you have. And normative defeaters would be counter evidence, very broadly speaking. Okay, so counter evidence that you have that is such that you ought to believe that either that P is true or that your basis for believing that P is not a good one. Okay. Now, so what I want to suggest is that with this kind of framework in mind, the considerations that are put forward by the proponent of the argument from Locke are such that they give us a defeater. Okay, so that's going to be the premise that I'm going to be defending. Okay, so the first point is that the fact that there is significant contingency involved in the formation of our religious beliefs either does or should make us doubt whether they are formed in an epistemically appropriate way. Okay, so what I have in mind is this, okay? If we look around and we, you know, let's kind of think about the news sources again. If we looked around and we saw that there were, you know, kind of 10 different sources of news, okay? And each group of people that relied on those 10 different news sources all had conflicting, you know, they had, you know, shared some beliefs but had a lot of conflicting beliefs. And then we realized, you know, kind of when we reflected on it, we're like, wow, we all rely on different news sources. We all, you know, kind of have different beliefs when we rely on those different news sources. The question we would want to ask ourselves is, well, wait a minute, how did I get put in touch with this particular news source? Okay, what is it about this particular news source that is, that explains why I'm, you know, getting these beliefs rather than one of the others? And given the story that I've told, if we realize that it was just through this kind of, you know, this flip of the coin, it was just a matter of luck, or even if it's such that I just have, you know, I realize that there's no way to tell whether I was put in touch with these particular beliefs for a kind of, you know, like a deliberate or an intentional reason, then it looks like I ought to kind of doubt whether I'm being guided by broad processes that are truth conducive. Okay. So, so I think that this is, in a way, like I said, the premise of the, you know, the premise that we find in the passages from, like, Hick and from, I didn't read the one from Montaigne, but it's on the back. That, I mean, I don't think that I'm saying anything, you know, kind of different than what they said in kind of defending this kind of premise. All I'm saying is that when we think about their premise, and when the average person does, it should make you think, it should make you question whether the broad processes that you're relying on are putting you in touch with the truth. Okay. Okay. Let me see. So here's another way that I put the point. Okay. So so since it does seem like it's just, I mean, to kind of get a better handle on the luck. I mean, I don't want to go into this in too much detail, but when we think about, like, the massive amounts of contingency involved, not only in, like, the, I mean, so a lot of people talk about the accident of our birth, okay? But it's not just, like, the accident of our birth. It's also the accident of, like, kind of the dominant religion in this particular region, right, of the world. And we can imagine kind of wars turning out differently and conflict resolving itself differently, and there just being all of these different ways in which that there was a particular religion here, or that there was a particular kind of testimonial community here, and I ended up finding myself in it, is just a matter of contingent fact. Okay. And given this, I say that this should give me a reason to doubt that the beliefs that I form on the basis of this broader process is not guided by true conducive features. Okay, now of course I'm sure it's immediately noted that many of the beliefs that I have about non-religious matters also seem kind of dependent on on the particular environment I'm in too, right? So some of the examples I give, I learned about gravity and antibiotics, the location of Paris, and a host of other facts from my parents and teachers and peers. But then it looks like, shouldn't I doubt the broad process by which I acquire these beliefs too, since it's simply a matter of luck that I had the parents, teachers, maybe not the parents, but anyway, the teachers and peers that I did. Okay. Or perhaps the parents who raised me. How about that? Okay. Anyway. So I want to draw a distinction, okay, between two different kinds of beliefs. So I think on the one hand, there are those that I call largely socially environmentally independent and those that are socially environmentally dependent. And so I call these SE independent and SE dependent beliefs for short. Here's one way of cashing this out. But I think ultimately, let me tell you what I'm after, because I think that there's an explanatory version of this distinction too. So what I'm really interested in here are those beliefs that kind of in a way ultimately bottom out in testimony, and those beliefs that don't, okay? And where by that I mean they are such that if you did not necessarily, let me just cash out this distinction and then I think it'll be easier to get a handle on that. Okay. So some beliefs, like the ones that I mentioned, like about gravity and antibiotics, would be roughly the same regardless of where one grew up. For instance, if one was raised in the Middle East or in Chicago, one would still believe that Paris is in France. I mean, I know this is, obviously there are some exceptions, but it's generally the case. But it's not the case for most religious beliefs, because obviously where one was raised often makes a significant difference. So here's one way of understanding the difference between SE independence and SE dependence. S is belief that P is socially environmentally independent only if S believes that P in the actual world and in the set of nearest possible worlds in which S grew up in a substantially different social environment. And S is belief that P is socially environmentally dependent only if S believes that P in the actual world, but not in the set of nearest possible worlds in which S grew up in a substantially different social environment. Now, of course, I'm talking about the social environment, not the physical environment. I mean, obviously, if I had grown up in a different physical environment, I'd have lots of other different beliefs, but I'm talking about the testimonial community specifically, if that's what the whole paper's about, obviously. But I think even with this clarification, there's a further distinction that I want to draw. So obviously this distinction, I mean, it's not going to come out that and let me just say too, that like, it doesn't really matter to me so much that, I'm not making a general claim about all religious beliefs, right? I'm not going to say that like, SE dependent beliefs, all religious beliefs are SE dependent beliefs, and therefore all SE dependent beliefs are irrational or unjustified or anything like that, right? I'm making a claim specifically about SE-dependent beliefs, and I think that purely testimonial beliefs are SE-dependent beliefs. Okay. Okay, so among those beliefs that are dependent on the social environment, I think that there are some that are not at all epistemically problematic. So here's an example I give. Suppose that there's an alien community that's far more scientifically advanced than any other. And in such a community, the member's scientific beliefs would be such that they hold them in the actual world, but not in the set of nearest possible worlds in which they grew up in a substantially different social environment. We still wouldn't think that they should doubt them. So what I draw a further distinction that I think is helpful here. And what I say is that the kinds of SE-dependent beliefs that I think are problematic are those that are thoroughly SE-dependent. Okay. So I, how I characterize that is that those SE-dependent beliefs that are ultimately justified only by further SE-dependent beliefs, and these are the ones that are epistemically problematic. Okay, so let me explain a little bit more. This is, I have this full paragraph on your handout because I think it's an important one, so the distinction. Okay, so the sense in which the early SE-dependent beliefs are ultimately justified only by further SE beliefs is relative, that's SE-dependent beliefs, sorry, is relative to a community's or society's body of beliefs, not an individual's. So thoroughly SE-dependent beliefs, what I say, is ultimately bottom out in SE-dependent beliefs, where this means that there are no members of the relevant community, past or present, to whom one could appeal for an SE-independent basis for the belief. So a paradigm of a thoroughly SE-dependent belief is one that is grounded in the authority of a text, without the text in turn being grounded in a non-testimonial source. And in contrast, for beliefs that are not thoroughly SE-dependent, like scientific beliefs, they are members of one's community, past or present, and can defend them by appeal to the results of experiments and studies, even in cases where one can't do this oneself. Now, the relevance of this distinction is that when beliefs are so socially dependent like this, right, and we're aware that it just looks like it's just a coincidence, right? We can't rule out, how about this, we can't rule out that it's just a coincidence that we ended up in one community rather than another. Then it looks like we have reason to doubt the broad process by which we are forming our religious beliefs, okay? Because they bottom out completely in the social environment, okay? So thoroughly SE-dependent beliefs are those that, you know, have no necessary contact with the, you know, kind of, there's nothing built into it that has some contact with the world. Okay, so with that said, what I say is, if a subject S has a reason to believe that her belief that P is thoroughly SE-dependent, then she has a reason to doubt that the broad process involved in the production of the belief is properly aimed at the truth. Normally functioning adults who hold religious beliefs purely on the basis of testimony from within a tradition, that's Greco's phrase, that's the phrase that I use, have reason to believe that their beliefs are thoroughly SE-dependent. So normally functioning adults who hold religious beliefs purely on the basis of testimony from within a tradition have reason to doubt that the broad process involved in the production of their religious beliefs is aimed at the truth. If S has a reason to doubt this, then S is a normative undercutting defeater for believing that P. Normally functioning adults who hold religious beliefs purely on the basis of testimony from within a tradition have normative undercutting defeaters for their beliefs. These kinds of beliefs are unjustified and can't amount to knowledge unless they have defeaters. So religious beliefs held purely on the basis of testimony from within a tradition are unjustified and can't amount to knowledge unless the subject in question possesses a defeater. Okay, so I just want to make a couple of clarificatory points. Let me see how much time I have. Okay, I need to pick up the pace. Okay, so the first point I want to make is that I don't think that like subjects have the concept of SE dependence or anything like that, like in condition one. Premise one is really just supposed to kind of be the observation that I think everybody has had, right? I mean, like from a very young age. Wow, my friends over there grew up with those people and grew up with that community and grew up, you know, in that environment. And had I probably would have those beliefs too, right? So I don't expect there to be the concept of SE dependence in any sort of, you know, kind of philosophical sense in condition one. I'm taking just this very loose reading of it. Second, the premise two is restricted just to normally functioning adults. I don't think that, you know, we have the same kinds of normative expectations for, you know, cognitively disabled adults or young children. It only concerns, number three, it only concerns those religious beliefs that are based purely on the testimony from within a tradition, which, like I said, is kind of what Greco and we're going to see is Zagzebski is interested in. If one's religious beliefs are, you know, kind of grounded in perceptual seemings or in, you know, reason-based arguments, such as the ontological argument or something like that, then, I mean, I don't think that this argument, I mean, I'm dealing specifically, like I said, with the purely testimony-based beliefs. And I think this is due to the fact that there's contingency involved in the testimony that one is exposed to that's not necessarily present when one is grounded in perceptual of seemings or reason-based or something like that. And finally, I mean, this is like kind of really the heart of the view, right? The real kind of point that I wanna make is that the conclusion of the paper is not at all that testimonially justified religious beliefs are unjustified or irrational, or even that fully SE-dependent beliefs, thoroughly SE-dependent beliefs are unjustified or irrational. That's not the conclusion. The conclusion is a challenge has been raised about accidentality or contingency, and we need a response to that, right? We can't just go to the epistemology of testimony to answer that. So, I want to be very clear, like, this is in a way like the heart of the paper, right? You just need a defeater, like a challenge has been raised. I mean, it sort of was like a long-winded section of the paper to get to the point to say, like, the accidentality of our birth, the contingency of our birth, this is a, you know, kind of a perennial problem in the philosophy of religion. It raises a challenge. It should kind of give us doubt, right? And I give you some reasons why it should raise a doubt. And now you need an answer, right? And I'm not making any claims at all that there's not an answer, that there's not a good answer. I'm saying we need to do philosophy of religion, right? Because the answer is not going to be found in the epistemology of testimony. It's not going to be found by trying to conceive of testimony in terms of transmission or trying to conceive of testimony as non-reductionist or anything like that, okay? So for instance, someone might have an argument that says that their community is privileged, right? Or someone might have an argument that says that they have reason to believe that their community is privileged, right? Okay. Or they might have reason to believe that it's not merely a matter of luck that they ended up in Chicago rather than the Middle East or something like that. I mean, go for it, right? I mean, the main point is just that the epistemology of testimony is not going to help here. So that's what I mean when I say that we can't seek refuge in the epistemology of testimony when we have, in dealing with these perennial problems in the philosophy of religion. The problem of luck persists, okay? There's different versions of it. I've defended the traditional version through, in a way, like my coin toss example, and then I've defended a slightly different version through us kind of thinking about luck, raising some questions about the broad process by which we're forming our religious beliefs. And these challenges need to be engaged in a way on their own terms. So that's kind of what I want to say about Greco. I'm going to skip. So I started at 20 after. Oh, so I only have like 7 minutes left. Yeah, okay, I'll be quick. Okay, I was always planning to skip section 2, just so you know. I was. You can ask Charity, she's already heard this paper, and I skipped it at the last conference too. There's just no way to get through it all. Okay, so in this section, I want to look at authority. I really actually think that this is, I've had a really fun time thinking through this. So, because I think some really interesting questions arise. But so some of you might know Linda Zagzebski has this recent book on authority, and she models her conception of authority on Joseph Raz's conception of authority in the political domain. Okay. And what she wants to argue is that beliefs can be justified, purely, totally authority-based beliefs can be rational, epistemically rational. Okay, so it's important that we keep that in mind. Obviously, the whole, everything we're talking about is in the epistemic domain. Okay. And so just a couple of clarificatory points about her view. So the way she understands authority, I think this is all on your handout, is that it is a normative power that generates reasons for others to do or to believe something preemptively. Okay? And as I said, like following Raz, the way she understands this is that a preemptive reason is a reason that replaces other reasons that a subject has. Okay, that's what it means for a reason to be replaced, to be preemptive in this sense. Okay. So how she understands this is that like when you get the testimony from authority, it's not as though you say, oh, okay, so So I have all of these reasons for believing that Oxford is in the UK, okay? And then Peter also tells me that Oxford is in the UK. And so I just kind of add that to my, you know, kind of stock of evidence or stock of reasons for that. And now I have an even stronger basis for this. Okay. Zepsi says, look, if it's really an authority-based belief, I mean, if you're really believing on the basis of someone being an authority, that's not how it goes. Okay. Authorities give you preemptive reasons. Okay. These are not reasons that are aggregated with your other reasons, weighed against your other reasons. Okay. These are reasons that are preemptive. Okay. Now, she uses talk of replacement, right? She says that they replace all of the other reasons you have. But I mean, I think that that, well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is just my reading of her. I mean, I think it's, I mean, like, when I replace, like, my winter coat, for instance, I mean, I throw out my other one. You know what I mean? I throw out my old winter coat. And so, I mean, I don't even know exactly what that means, like, to, you know, kind of throw out my other reasons. But here's, I think, what she has in mind. When you believe on the basis of authority, it normatively screens off the power of the other reasons you have. Okay, they're just you know, kind of normatively blocked, so to speak, right? Okay, because you're not aggregating. I mean, what she definitely says is that you are not weighing, you're not aggregating. You know, they're not interacting at all with the reasons that you have. Okay, so when the authority says P. To believe it on the basis of that authority is to just take that authority's testimony, you know, kind of as it is, not, you know, against the other stuff that you have. So here's one of the things she says. She says, you should let the authority stand in for you in your attempt to get the truth in that domain and to adopt the authority's belief without deliberation. Okay. Okay, now, she thinks that there are two different ways that we can justify authority in this sense. Okay. One is if I conscientiously judge that I'm more likely to form a true belief rather than a false belief if I trust another person, or if I conscientiously judge that I'm more likely to form a belief that survives conscientious reflection by trusting someone else. Okay. So conscientious reflection is, in a way, I mean, like, she kind of is pretty loose about this. It's just sort of like doing the best that you can, given what you have. You know what I mean? Like, so it's not externalist at all. It's really in the realm of just rationality. She thinks it's just sort of like it survives your critical reflection. Okay. So, two different ways I can choose an authority rationally. One is I conscientiously judge that if I rely on you, I'm more likely to get at the truth. Or I conscientiously judge that I'm more likely to form beliefs that will survive my conscientious reflection. Okay. So it's sort of like, why bother doing the conscientious reflection myself? I know you and I are like-minded, right? I'm just going to defer to you because I know that what you tell me is so likely, or actually more likely to survive my conscientious reflection than forming beliefs myself. So with this framework, we can see that it's just it's, you know, kind of just a small step from all of that to the justification of beliefs formed on the basis of religious authority. Because just as I might conscientiously judge that an individual is more likely to get me to the truth, or more likely to get me to beliefs that survive my conscientious reflection, it's very easy to see that so too can I do this with respect to communities. And so this is the thesis that she espouses. The authority of my religious community is justified for me by my conscientious judgment that if I engage in the community, following its practical directives and believing its teachings, the result will survive my conscientious self-reflection upon my total set of psychic states better than if I try to figure out what to do and believe in the relevant domain in a way that is independent of us. So, like I said, if one conscientiously judges that following the teachings of one's religious community is more likely to produce true beliefs that you think are true or that are going to survive conscientious reflection, then you're justified in deferring. And so let's just call this the authority view of the rationality of religious beliefs. So I think the authority view has some, I mean, she uses this view to deal with a lot of just like standard problems for the rationality of religious belief. And one of the most significant ones is the response that she's able to give to the to challenges facing religious belief. So here's one that I think is particularly telling. So obviously, one of the standard things that comes up is, what about disagreement, right? I mean, obviously, there's a lot of disagreement about most of our religious beliefs, and doesn't disagreement challenge the rationality of our religious beliefs? And one of the things that's interesting to note is that when you have a belief on the basis of authority, and it's done, and it's functioning in this kind of preemptive way, that can kind of stand in and sort of like protect you from future counter-evidence, right? So she says, if a belief is firmly rooted in a network of other beliefs and has already survived considerable self-reflection, it can be reasonable to treat putative evidence against it as either false or misleading. This is because it's possible to conscientiously trust a belief more than even a substantial amount of putative evidence against it. Okay. But I think one of the things that that Zagzebski is able to do here is to say, look, once the authority is kind of functioning in this preemptive way so that it's not aggregative and it's not weighing, okay, then it doesn't really have to interact with this counter-evidence, right? It doesn't really have to be such that I'm kind of weighing, well, there's the disagreement, there's what my, the authority figure in my religious community tells me, but then there's all this disagreement. What should I do? Who do I trust? I mean, once you've got the authority figure in place, right, you don't have to weigh all of the other evidence and all of the, and aggregate it with all the other evidence, right? It just kind of preempts all the other stuff. Okay, so it's very easy to see that on this model, Zagzebski provides the resources for obviously justified religious beliefs, but justified religious beliefs that bottom out purely in authority, right? The authority of someone in the community, the authority of a text, the authority of a community. But I want to raise some problems for this approach. The first one that I want to bring is that one question that we might have, I'm skipping around on the handout, just in the interest of time. So one question we might have is how it is that we go about rejecting an authority's testimony when it's obviously false or otherwise outrageous. Okay. So suppose that I identify someone as an authority, it survives my conscientious reflection, right? I kind of say that this person is, their testimony is going to provide me with preemptive reasons. But then they say something to me that is outrageous, okay? So, I mean, there's like morally outrageous claims, factually outrageous claims, right? I mean, so someone, so I have an authority, and then, I go, the doctor is my authority, I'm gonna take the reasons that he gives me as preemptive, and then he tells me to, here's your prescription, you need to take, 400,000 pills a day. Now keep in mind, if this is an authority, right, I don't take that, that's interesting. Okay, now I'm gonna weigh that with all of my other background reasons that suggest that that's like an outrageous amount of pills to be taking, right? I mean, and then I'm going to say, look, I think I have more background evidence for thinking that this is, that you're wrong than that, I should, take you to be an authority on this, right? Or we can imagine, I think more realistically, and I think more problematically perhaps, outrageous claims made in the moral domain. So I think that there are all sorts of religious communities where, I know of some of these communities, I know of some of my friends and, kind of family members who have, kind of pastors or people who tell them this, who just tell them that, a woman's place is in the home or something like that. Like they should not be, working outside of the house or something like that. I mean, I think that that's kind of, I think that's outrageous, right? Even if it's like a normative claim. And yet it looks like, how do you get from recognizing someone as an authority to kind of taking something that they say to be outrageous or to be something, you know, obviously false, once they've been identified as an authority. Because like I said, it's not one piece of evidence to be weighed against the others. And so another way of putting this is like why one person's testimony would swamp all of my other relevant evidence on the question, especially when the report in question is, you know, clearly false. Now, Zagzebski is aware of this kind of general problem, like although very, very briefly. So here's the response. Suppose the authority's belief is something outrageous. Can't that count as a defeater? Yes, it can, but that doesn't count against preemption. And she gives the physician example. As long as you conscientiously think the physician is a better guide, you have reason to take the physician's directive as one that preempts our own decision about what we should do in that domain. But, you know, she says, I assume that you trust your belief that you should not take so many pills more than you trust your judgment that your physician is an authoritative guide to your health. Now, the bottom part is a little bit perplexing because she's saying, like, so long as you continue to regard this person as an authority, you should, you know, the physician's directive, it should be one that preempts your own decision about what you should do. The relevant question is, if you've kind of normatively screened off all of the other relevant evidence that you have, so that it's not like a kind of a weighing game, you're not kind of always like sort of factoring in it, where something like, here's like the alternative model, right? The authority's testimony is just so epistemically significant, or so epistemically powerful, or you give it so much weight, that it always kind of trumps the other evidence you have. That's the competing model, right? I mean, the competing model is not one where, you know, you give the authority's testimony equal weight as you give your own testimony, or equal weight as you give to, like, a peer or something like that, but that you just give it a significant amount of weight. Okay, that's the competing model. So one question we might have is, if all of that other evidence is kind of being normatively screened off so that you're not kind of like tapping into it, then it's unclear how the testimony can even, how it even strikes you as absurd or clearly false, given that once you take the testimony of the authority, you're supposed to kind of just take their word for it within the absence of deliberation. And I think that the response to this is, I think, a really kind of interesting argument and worth kind of thinking about. So Joseph Raz gives one version of it, and then Zagzebski talks about some experimental studies that show the same thing. So let me start with the Zagzebski point. She says that studies were done on humans and rats, where the rats come out better. I'm done? Oh, 5 minutes? Oh, yeah, that's good. I mean, I'll be done in 5. Yeah, so studies were done on humans and rats, in which the goal was to try to predict when the green light as many times as you could. Okay. And Zagzebski says what the humans did would be to try to figure out, you know, kind of, okay, is this going to be green or red? Is this going to be green or red? And they tried to find some kind of pattern or something, and they tried to kind of use their own cognitive faculties to predict when it was going to be green. Whereas the rats were just like green, 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 green. Okay. So if the light was green 75% of the time, they got it right 75% of the time. Right? Because they just picked green every single time. Whereas the humans would get it lower than 75% because they were trying to discriminate. Okay? This is exactly what Zagzebski says is the problem with the model that I would favor, right? My model. She's saying, look, your model says you should be acting like the humans, not like the rats. My model says we ought to act like the rats. Okay? And Joseph Raz says the same thing. He says, suppose I can identify a range of cases in which I'm wrong more than the putative authority. Suppose I decide because of this to tilt the balance in all those cases in favor of its solution. That is, in every case, I will first make up my own mind independently of the authority's verdict, and then in those cases in which my judgment differs from its, I will add a certain weight to the solutions favored by it on the grounds that it, the authority, knows better than I. This procedure will reverse my independent judgment in a certain proportion of the cases. Sometimes, even after giving the argument favored by the authority an extra weight, it will not win. On other occasions, the additional weight will make all the difference. how will I fare under this procedure? If, as we are assuming, there is no other relevant information available, then we can expect that in the cases in which I endorse the authority's judgment, my rate of mistakes declines and equals that of the authority. In the cases in which even now I contradict the authority's judgment, the rate of my mistakes remains unchanged, i.e. greater than that of the authority. This shows that only by allowing the authority's judgment to preempt mine altogether will I succeed in improving my performance and bringing it to the level of the authority. Okay. So what both Raz and Zagzebski say, they're making two different claims here. I mean, I think that they tend to run them together, but they're making two claims. They're saying, if we care about the truth, okay, and if we have identified someone as an authority, okay, one, this is a quote from Raz, once we identify an expert, we should follow that person's advice all of the time, okay, and we ought to do so preemptively. Okay, and that's because we want to end up like the rats and not the humans. Okay, so very quickly, I'm just going to raise three problems with, I think this is actually one of the most interesting arguments on behalf of the preemption thesis. So three problems. So first, just a minor point. It's not clear to me how this is compatible with, and in fact, Raz, I think, has... I've noticed that other people have made this objection to Raz's view of political authority. It's not clear how this meshes with the response to outrageous or false testimony, right? If the idea is you identify an authority and you trust them every single time, then it looks like you ought to trust them even when it's outrageous or false, right? It's precisely when you start trying to say, like, gosh, I don't really think that, I don't really think that, that you get into trouble, right? Okay, so says the, yeah, so says the Duke. Okay. The second problem that I want to raise is that even if they're right about that we ought to trust all the time, nothing about this argument, I mean, I don't know, maybe someone here will convince me otherwise, but I just can't see how this argument gets us preemption. At most, if it works, I see that it gets us that we should trust all the time. But I don't see how that it gets that we should trust all the time preemptively. Okay? I don't see why it can't be the case that we just say, look, this authority is just so good that, you know, I'm just going to give this just huge amount of weight, right? So much that, like, nearly every time it's going to tip the scale, right? And it looks like we might end up, like, just de facto, exactly like the rats in such a case, even though we're not trusting preemptively. Okay? But I also... don't see how we get that we ought to trust all the time either. So I'm not happy with that response either, because it looks like there are various ways that we can kind of have the principle so that we still get the same result. So trust the authority all the time, except when I know that they're wrong. Okay. In which case, I'm going to end up better than the authority, right? I mean, if you're uncomfortable with that, then it can just be something like, you know, trust the authority every time except when I'm certain that the authority is wrong, okay? So I don't think we get preemption. I don't think that we get all of the time. And I think that by going, this argument actually challenges the response that they gave to the outrageous authority's testimony problem. Okay, my own view is that there are no religious beliefs grounded in authority, where I think a very plausible interpretation of authority is that they kind of, you know, sort of preempt your other reasons. So I don't think that there is any justified authority-based based testimony. So in conclusion, let me just kind of say, wrap this up. I think that these attempts that I think I'm seeing emerging in the epistemology of testimony to try to justify religious beliefs through this, through, you know, kind of certain ways of understanding testimony or through certain ways of conceiving of the epistemology of testimony are just not going to work. I think that, you know, like I said, these kinds of challenges to religious belief need to be met, you know, with other kind of, you know, responses in the philosophy of religion. And so, like I said, one of my slogans is, like, no cheap comfort can be found in the epistemology of testimony. That's it.
Okay, you know the rules? Someone come in first?
Yeah. That's one of the rules.
like the paper, then there's some things I agree with, but I just wanted to focus on one thing. Your formulation of SE independence on page 3, I think, is really problematic. Where it has that I would have to not only take a leap of mind to survive this test, it has to be such that I believe that in the set of nearest possible worlds we have broken a substantially different social environment. You know, so if I were to have grown up in a nomadic community in Kurdistan, right, there's lots of paradigmatically reasonable things I believe now that I wouldn't believe, right? The facts I learned about U.S. history in school, I'm probably not going to learn a lot of those other than the obvious ones. I'm going to learn a lot of scientific beliefs. I'm not going to believe that my name is Tim, that I'm an American. I have a different name. Right, so surely that's too strong, and so then it seems like you need something like to add on to it and has substantially the same relevant evidence as one has in this world, or maybe to make it relevant to the testimonial transmission idea, is presented with the same testimonial chain or something like that. But it doesn't seem to me that you'll get the result you want in that case.
Okay, why not? So if you remember, I was kind of saying at the start, I mean, like, if I had like maybe an hour, I would have said, I mean, I think that there are, I should probably lay my cards on the table. I think that the modal version is probably not the best version to go with for the SE independent and SE dependent beliefs. I've become convinced of that. So I'm more inclined now to go with like an explanatory version. So what I'm more interested in is, in a way, the phenomenon. So I'm interested in kind of the beliefs. And so I'm trying to look for like a, you know, kind of some sort of general thing, so I don't just say, oh, it's the beliefs that just bottom out purely in testimony.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's kind of ultimately what I'm interested in, the beliefs that just bottom out in testimony, either because it's an authoritative text or because it's authoritative figures, you know, like,
yeah,
you know, that sort of thing. And so those sorts of beliefs are such that, those kinds of beliefs, because I'm interested in sort of like the fact that there's the kind of contingency that I'm involved. So I thought that I was kind of capturing your worry in the thoroughly part.
So you're saying we're just gonna chuck the idea of what we would have been? No,
I'm saying that, I'm saying that, like, what I'm saying is, like, so response number one is, I think at least some of your worries are dealt with in the thoroughly SE dependent part.
Okay.
So,
but that, I'm just thinking to characterize, it's going to be difficult to even sort of coherently characterize what we're imagining in these alternative scenarios.
Because it's hard to imagine
because
the social.
How do you transplant Spain based, you give me, having grown up in totally different, being educated in different ways, and then but nevertheless give to me the same body of evidence that I have.
So I see. So you're saying that
that's
it's hard
one worry.
To... Right.
And then another worry is that some beliefs are not going to survive. Even where I grew up, I've grown up in a different environment, and somehow I acquired the same evidence for beliefs that I have now that are rational beliefs. Say where there's a kind of strong commitment within the community to resist arguments, you know, not just in religious cases, but in, you know, scientific beliefs or whatever. So I just see a lot of problems with
Let me just ask a clarification. Well, Lizzie, did you want to jump in on this?
Just want to point out that you don't say if and only if, you just say only if.
That's right.
So, which is really important. You're giving that. So it was if and only if, then there'll be these problems.
No, the only if was problem enough, because it's going to, it's not going to be, right, it's a necessary condition.
What?
He has a follow-up, I don't know if it's...
Well, can I answer this one first?
Okay.
Yeah. So I take it that... let me just see if this is one of the problems. So I'm trying to restrict understanding the modal claims to social environment.
Okay.
And are you trying to say that it's really hard to understand these conditions by individual... Like, yanking out all... holding fixed the non-social environment and then asking questions about what the social environment is.
I think that's
one way of understanding the question, that like individuating the social environment is going to be challenging. Here's one way to go, and this is kind of the way that I become increasingly, you know, kind of tempted by. is that the social environment are those beliefs that, like I said, are ultimately bottom out in testimony, the purely testimonial ones. I mean, that's at least, I think, it makes it like more straightforward, right? The ones that kind of bottom out, you know, not in some sort of, you know, ultimately in some sort of firsthand evidence, but like ultimately bottom out in some sort of, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm worried about that too. You know, ultimately, they involve firsthand experiences, presumably, right?
Yeah. Which
does. Text-based communities, right? But sorry, I don't want to be monopolizing the
session. So you can strike my hand.
So I'll just let me pull back and let others jump in.
Okay. Sorry, this is actually exactly what bothered me out. So my worry is that actually that's not going to, so the you say it's those are kind of thoroughly socially dependent, sorry. The relevant notion of social dependence is the one that thoroughly bottom out in social environment, and that's bottoming out the testimony.
Mm-hmm.
So my worry is that that's actually not going to be enough to get any challenge going to religious belief. Because if I think of my very, very Catholic Polish relatives, you know, they don't hold their religious beliefs merely on testimony. They will, when you press them, they will appeal to certain factors. They will say, you know, I had this, I prayed to the Virgin Mary, and then this happened, and these other things. So they have lots of evidence that they point to.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the only reason why they regard this as evidence for their religious beliefs is because they grew up in the relevant social environment. So it seems like kind of the religious environment, it's not, you know, in some sense, even these factors are strongly socially dependent because they do kind of are dependent on the social environment they grew up with. But they don't bottom out in testimony.
Right. So then, I mean, like, if there, I mean, and I kind of said that at the start of the talk, if you remember. So I'm interested really in the kind of movement that we see in like Greco and Zagzebski. So one way of understanding your point is like the scope is kind of narrow, right? Because you're saying like most, you know, maybe, well, I mean, I don't know, most religious beliefs just aren't of this sort. You're saying like your Polish relatives, it's not like this, right? But I'm going to start, I said at the outset that I'm interested in, like, if you remember, like, what Greco was trying to defend are religious beliefs based on the testimony from within a tradition. Okay, he's interested in, like, in a way, Greco and Zagzebski are interested in the same thing. Zagzebski's interested in beliefs that just bottom out in authority. Right? It's not as though she's saying, that either of these authors is saying, that, but then it's supplemented with all of this other experience that I get, that I add to the testimonial base. Right?
Right, but I think actually this, it does raise a worry because I agree that I think if the social dependence, the relevant worry kind of social dependence is wider than just testimonial, and then it's true in some sense that just appealing to the epistemology of testimony might not get them kind of what they want. But pressing...
I didn't follow that.
Sorry. Actually, you know what? Let's move because there are lots of other, and I'm going to formulate this more coherently for after.
Okay, but anyway, I mean, I guess the bottom line I wanted to say was that, I mean, I think that, I mean, I said at the outset, like, if most religious beliefs are supplemented with, like, something epistemic that you get, I mean, it has to be epistemic, of course.
Right.
Right? I mean, like, so I just am not speaking to any of that. Does prayer have epistemic significance? I have no idea. Does, you know, does, like, seeing a sunset and thinking this is from God, you know, give you a perception. I have no idea. If there is that kind of stuff, go for it. But this is, again, my general claim. Start doing, just do philosophy of religion, right?
Epistemology rather than philosophy of religion.
Well, I think that it would be specifically the epistemology of religious belief. But anyway, this is, I'm using this kind of loosely. But I mean, if your claim is that most beliefs have this perceptual and prayer-based epistemic support, then I kind of would say that that's okay. I'm really interested in just purely testimony or authority-based beliefs. I mean, maybe authority is a better way of thinking about it for both Greco and Zagzebski.
Okay, got two follow-ups, Mikkel and John.
Yeah, I mean, it's really more the same, but I do think people are pointing to attention. There's a sense in which authority, social environment-dependent criterion is both too weak and both too strong, right? So it's too strong in that it overgenerates two cases.
Wait, I'm just to get clear on. It's authority, and it's the, is it the social dependence,
it's
or is
authority,
it?
Authority, social dependence criteria.
You're just using those interchangeably. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So that is a criterion to dissociate the case of good scientific knowledge that you're lucky to have with bad religious lucky that your bad religious testimony that you're lucky to have on the reliabilist account.
That you're what will have?
Lucky to have on the reliabilist account because you're lucky to be in touch with the right authorities. Right. So you want to dissociate between the two by postulating, okay, you can dissociate by the authority, social, environment dependent. And what Tim has pointed out, there's a class of justified testimonial belief that's going to be ruled out the criteria, namely truth about purely social, conventional, testimonial facts, right? So if I say something, you know, Barcelona fans testify that they don't like Madrid fans, then it bottoms out in testimony, but you can surely know it, right? So once the class of facts includes social, purely testimonial facts, it's going to overgenerate and rule those out. I took that to be a very good point.
Oh, okay.
And spin on it, right? So you don't want to rule out testimony justified social knowledge, right?
Yeah.
And on the other hand, it's too weak for Paulina style reasons, right? Because testimony about testimony is an empirical fact as much as anything else. And is that bottoming out? No, that seems more like on the evidential side. So once you have thoroughly, you need to intertwine the testimonial evidence with one factual thing. And then it gets really murky, right? Because in scriptures there will be stuff like, well, the prophet went to the mountain and the prophet talked to God. And the first count is going to be an empirical fact that's part of the evidence, right? So it seems like it's too strong in the way that it rules out justified social testimonial knowledge, and it's too weak in so far as if you intertwine the testimonial evidence with one empirical fact, and it seems like people do, then they're off the hook as far as the authority criterion goes.
Okay, so there's a lot there. So let me
just two
start.
Things really.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of different points. So let me start with the last one. So you were saying that, you know, like in these sort of texts that there are empirical claims made. But again, I mean, I take it that, so I mean, like one way of reading your and, you know, the criticism that Paulina had is that, this just doesn't subsume many cases, or it just has kind of a narrow scope. Because, I mean, I take it that people who rely on the text being authoritative do not regard, I mean, that's, I mean, like, it's the authority of the text that's grounding the doing the epistemic work, right? I mean, that's why Zagzebski has a whole book on authority, right? I mean, she has chapters and chapters on authority, and then it ends with, this is like fundamental, right? This is just basic. You take this as an authoritative text. You don't look at the claims in the text and say, well, here's an empirical claim. Let me go out and try to talk to the people who might be like related to the chain, who actually saw Jesus rise from the dead or something like that, right? I mean, it's the text is authoritative. And so, I mean,
I don't want to say the devil's advocate, but Greco's advocate, I suppose, right? So I think the charitable interpretation is that people have sort of a coherent worldview where the testimonial stuff plays a very important role. But it's also important that the prophet went to the mountain, because if the prophet didn't go to the mountain, how on earth else would he get to talk to God, right? So as long as the testimonial evidence is integrated with a further worldview, and that, I think, is the more charitable way of looking at the arguments.
Maybe you think it's epistemically charitable, but it's not charitable to what they're ultimately aiming. Like,
okay.
For instance, Zagzebski not only would disagree with that, like, she would vehemently disagree with that, right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, like, the whole point is, like, you're not aggregating, right? You're not kind of saying, like, let's take the evidence on behalf of this, let's take the evidence on behalf of that, let's aggregate that, let me pray, let me kind of have this perceptual experience, right? And this is why, like, John uses language like testimony from within a tradition, right? A tradition that is sort of like, He's not saying that you need to kind of go out and empirically verify the members of the tradition, right? Every claim that they make or that you need to kind of do. He's saying that, like, we can have a view where there's like a text that's authoritative or a community or members of a community that are authoritative. And this is what I mean. It can bottom out in their authority. That's what I mean. Like, it can bottom out in that authority. There's nothing else that needs to go on there. Just their testimony.
Okay. John?
I just want to understand better how the ideology is working. It connects to Tim's thing. Suppose Tim utters the words, I believe in God, and I form the belief that Tim said that he believes was a God, and B, that Tim believes was a God. There's two beliefs. Which of those are thoroughly SE-dependent, and which of those automatic testing?
You say that
there was a God, and I believe that he believes it was a God. I mean, it looks like both of those are strongly SE-dependent. Mm-hmm. They seem like totally awesome beliefs, by the way. And one or maybe both seem to bottom out in testimony, unless I'm not tracking the ideology.
Yeah, I mean, so what I was thinking is that, so the reason why you think that they seem thoroughly SE-dependent is because in order for him to justify those, it would appeal to further...
No, it's my belief about him.
Oh, your belief
that he believes.
A God. And you know, the reason
if you
why
take me to substantially different social environments, I won't believe that he believes there's a God.
And
my belief that he believes that there's a God is based on...
And so that if you were to go justify it, you would appeal to further SE-dependent beliefs?
Well, I mean, there'll be basic SE. I take it if there's a basic SE-dependent belief, that's thoroughly SE-dependent.
You heard me say it.
Yeah. If there's a basic SE-dependent belief...
I mean, I'm just not quite sure how the thoroughly... I mean, I understand SE-dependence is the...
So the idea is supposed to be that there are all sorts of beliefs that we get via testimony.
Right, like he believes
yeah,
it's
right.
a God.
And those are totally fine, right? So standard testimonial beliefs are totally fine.
But why isn't that thoroughly SE-dependent? I'm just trying to understand the ideology.
Do you want to just so that you
I think you mean that they derive from the content of the testimony, where it's just the fact that someone made
the content of the testimony was, I believe that there's a God. That was the content.
Okay, so you're getting to his belief.
Yeah,
okay.
But that is the content of the testimony.
Yeah. So I was understanding it like this. There are obviously all sorts of testimony beliefs we get all the time. Most of them are totally fine. But then there are some beliefs that, like, with the justification for those or the support of those, and this is why I said I might, like, ultimately go in a more explanatory version rather than a modal version. The justification or the support that we have for those can only appeal to further SE-dependent beliefs, those beliefs that are, that kind of bottom out. Do you know what I mean? That, like, they have no kind of contact with the world ultimately. So your belief
he believes
this. I mean, I take it that there'd be.
So if there's that bottom line, he wouldn't easily lie to me, and he just said
he
believed.
That?
You know.
Well, I'm sorry. What did you say?
He wouldn't easily lie to me, and he just said he believed it, and that's
I believe.
Yeah, no. That's good.
I mean, that seems like it's bottoming out in testimony, kind of. I mean, unless it...
So, I guess I'm not really sure I see why what you'd be appealing to would only be further SE-dependent beliefs, and you have all sorts of beliefs about his... you know, kind of psychology, you're even saying, like, he doesn't, you know, he wouldn't easily lie to me. You've got, like, kind of, like a folk psychology about people's assertions and people's reports and, you know, that sort of
well,
thing.
When you decide to trust authorities, you think they're not just going to lie to you.
But good, that's fine, right? I mean, it's like if you want to trust authority and you want to have, like, justification for that or grounds for authority, I've never said anything
about... No, I don't have any evidence. I just think that.
No, but I mean, I take it that, I mean, I thought, I mean, I take it that you have a whole bunch of non-SE dependent beliefs about people's assertions and their psychological states and their beliefs and why they make certain reports and what motivation they have for making reports and what motivation they have for lying and these sorts of things. I don't take these to be purely SE
dependent. I see. So, but if I come into the world and I he says that and I think he believes that, then that's thoroughly SE dependent.
If you if that's all you, if that's, you know, then...
What I'm saying is it could be as safe as you like and be thoroughly SE dependent.
Yeah, so possibly, I mean, if you kind of isolate that. But I mean, I take it that the idea would be, I mean, maybe I could make it a would, like, you know, you would kind of defend it. You know, but anyway, I mean, I take it that, like, the standard testimonial beliefs are justified by a whole host of non-SE dependent beliefs. So, I mean, I just take it like at least in standard testimonial cases, these would be the kinds of beliefs we appeal to.
Okay, so let's start a new thread.
So I want to go back to something. I had this thought, I think it may follow on Paulina's point, but I think in a slightly different direction, Jennifer. So I'm worried about the close link between SE dependence and bottom-down testimony. And again, I confess I'm not fully sure I grasp SE dependence.
Yeah, yeah.
But I thought Paulina's point is that was actually an interesting one, because it strikes me that if I have understood your notion of SE dependence, there are ways of being SE dependent that doesn't involve bottoming out in testimony. The example that I think of is, if anything is SE dependent, our views in philosophy are SE dependent. You go to Oxford and you study epistemology, you're a knowledge person. I mean, but now notice, it's not merely because of John's or Tim, the other Tim's testimony. You actually think they have good reasons for it. Whereas if you study epistemology at Northwestern, you might not be a knowledge firster, but you'll think you have good reasons for it. So I want to highlight Paula's point, because what she said was that it's also your assessment of the evidence and the reasons. That may not bottom out testimony, but it's still social. So I was inviting you to see whether, do I understand what you mean by SE dependent? If so, am I right in thinking you're making too close a link between SE dependence and bottoming it out in testimony?
So you're saying that, so you think philosophical beliefs are generally SE dependent?
I worry that they are, yes.
Yeah, I'm not as inclined to think that, but that's okay. I mean, that's sort of like not a relevant issue. Although I'm sure you're familiar with like people who've put forth arguments about philosophical beliefs just like religious beliefs,
yeah.
Right? I mean, they've made exactly this argument. So I don't think, I mean, I think that it is pretty clear. If there is the problem with the religious belief case, and I think that we might find the same problem with philosophical beliefs. But then you were saying, look, we take these people to have reasons. And you were wondering, can you like say, like, why was that, how was that relating with, because I mean, I take it that, like, in the classic case of SE dependent beliefs, at least how I'm using that term, you might come to kind of, you know, accept someone as an authority because, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can imagine cases in which you accept someone as an authority without thinking that they have reasons, at least in the classic sense of reasons. They just have authority. I mean, like, maybe they just kind of... I mean, I don't know exactly what happens with the Pope when the Pope kind of speaks, you know, officially. Do you know what I mean? Does the Pope kind of have reasons and deliver... I mean, I don't exactly know, but I mean, I can imagine a case in where there is a Pope or a Pope-like figure, right, who just speaks on the basis of authority kind of directly. Right? And so I mean, again, like, I think that if you're thinking like you're kind of, you know, deliberating, you know, I think that that's more like the model that I favor, right? Where you're like, well, here's an authority. I think you've got really good reasons. I think I'm going to take your testimony into account, maybe give it substantial weight. Maybe it'll always kind of tip the balance in favor of my believing. You know, what you tell me, but when you say something outrageous, I've got all of this background evidence to tap into to deal with it. So I mean, maybe let me just one more thing. Maybe this is the better way of looking at it. To the extent that philosophy does model the kind of authoritative religious belief, then I think that it is in the same boat.
The point I was trying to make is that it's not in virtue of the authority, at least not in Zagzebski's sense of authority, that philosophy is like religion. It's in virtue of the point Paulina made about relatives, namely, our assessment of what we take to be the evidence and the reasons itself may be SE dependent.
Oh, then I guess I just am going to give the same answer I gave to Paulina. Those are just not the kinds of beliefs that are at issue.
Right, but did I understand your notion of SE dependence? What I'm suggesting is that there was a notion there, not quite the notion that you characterized when you characterized it as bottoming out in testimony, which strikes me as an interesting notion.
Uh-huh.
That's why I was inviting you to... So I don't know what to say about the Zagzebski case. I'm inclined to think you're right, I think. But this notion of SE dependence strikes me as a general notion, but it's the notion that's general is not the one that bottoms out in testimony. It's something else.
I see. Okay, so you're saying that, do you think that the ones that bottom out in testimony might be okay?
Oh, no comment on that.
Oh, I see. Okay, you're just saying there might be two distinct phenomena, one that bottoms out in testimony and then this other notion, and I'm linking those two too closely together. Yeah, I mean,
I'm going to stop.
Okay. Anyway, if that's partly the point, then I'm actually more inclined to be interested in the one that bottoms out in testimony, if that helps at all.
It does.
I mean, maybe one like lesson to be learned is, like, SE dependence might not be the way to capture, like, bottoming out in testimony in an authoritative fashion, right? I mean, I have the phenomenon, and, you know, that I'm more interested in arguing that there is no justification for religious beliefs that bottom out in authority. I mean, that's like maybe like the takeaway point, right? I try capturing that through SE dependence and SE independence. You know, I already became slightly convinced at the last conference I was at that the modal way is not going to, you know, I might need to go some sort of explanatory way. But the bottom line is, I don't think that there's any justification of fundamentally authority-based beliefs.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is just a tiny question about, like, it's not even about the talk, it's about, like, the terminology. It's about the terminology at the outset. So you have this notion of the normative field, and I was just sort of wondering if you could just say a word or two more about it, because I'm a little worried that, as it's specified, and as you're thinking about it, it looks like a normative field is basically necessary and sufficient for unjustified belief. And so you might think that then starts to look a little bit vacuous. So it looks like, so your assumption is basically that it's a sufficient condition for unjustified belief. But if you look at it, it also looks like, doesn't it say that it says that you have a normative defeater, if you have a doubt, no, it's a doubt or belief that this ought to have.
Mm-hmm.
But then if you have an unjustified belief, then there's a sense in which you ought to withhold or believe something else.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I have in mind, I mean, like the ought, the way I cash that out is usually in just terms of available counter evidence. So so I'm interested in using it in just the standard way that, like, there's some cases in which you've got, you know, kind of evidence that is such that you, if you know, you ought, it ought to make you doubt your belief, or it ought to make you, you know, have a counter belief, and yet you don't. So the idea is dogmatic defeaters are counter beliefs. Dogmatic defeaters are, I mean, normative defeaters are in a way counter beliefs that you ought to have, or counter, you know, dogs that you ought to have.
Okay, and
so at the step of the paper before we got to SE dependence, we had this stuff that you'd be lucky to get a reliable process, and that can be problematic for knowledge, uh-huh, even if the process you get in background. So we had these examples like, you flip a coin to decide which news channel to believe, mm-hmm, you fall down the stairs and get clairvoyance about French weather. I'm just meaning, it's not going to go, so just anytime you've got a coin flip upstream in the causal process, it's not gonna, the verdict's not going to go the same way every time.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance, if I like flip a coin to decide to look and see whether Tim's watching YouTube at this very moment. it comes up heads, so I look and I know, you know. But I might have thought, you know, if I didn't look at, on inductive grounds, I thought really likely he is, so I would have believed he was, you know. So like, or you know, like God flips a coin to decide if it comes up heads, God's going to give me a normal perceptual system to put me here, and tails, he's going to nap me and give me the same.
Okay.
You know, it feels like if it comes up heads, I still get to know I'm watching you do the talk, I've got hands and all that stuff. You know, so I'm just doing like some of these cases where there's a coin flip that leads to the true belief. You're lucky, and in other cases, it's going to feel more problematic, but you know, it feels like at that level, it might be interesting to think about like what divides the cases, you know?
I see. Yeah. So, I mean, I was just taking, I mean, good. I mean, I think that's a nice point. I mean, I was just taking coin tosses to be, like, paradigmatically,
yeah.
You know, cases in which we would have, if this is really the way in which you're choosing one new source over another, I mean, the way that I was kind of setting it up, the case, right?
Yeah.
So that you know these two new sources would give you radically different beliefs.
Well, yeah, so, I mean, one thing I do think it does show is that just the fact that there's kind of this random process choosing for you. You're using language kind of like that.
Uh-huh.
And just the fact that there's a random process, as it were, choosing for you doesn't automatically show that the belief stinks.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. So sort of what I'm inviting people to do is to say, look, I mean, this, in a way, the premise that I started with from, like, the Montaigne quote and the Hick quote is sort of inviting us to kind of think about, like, look, I mean, you know, there does seem to be this contingency. Is it the kind of problematic kind of luck, or is it the non-problematic kind of luck? So, yeah, I know, I totally agree with you. And then the idea is supposed to be, like, we have to basically rule out that we're in the problematic case. I mean, maybe that's one way of looking at it. Or, you know, and that is where I say you need a diffuser debate. So I'm totally sympathetic with the fact that there are these two different, you know, kinds of cases, that the mere fact that it's, you know, like, this doesn't mean...
Right, okay, I'll stop there, but yeah.
Okay, we've basically run out of time with at least six more questions and a few follow-ups. Would you be okay to take one more?
Yeah, that's fine. Mm-hmm.
Okay, Max, ask.
Seeing as mine is so similar to Billy's, get mine.
Okay,
I was just a bit puzzled about your argument from lack of irrationality of the
degree.
I'm not sure about this, but what do you think about if we try to generalize this to agnostic and atheist communities? Isn't there a problem? Because then we get conclusions that we have undercutting the features also for religious beliefs that there is God, either there is God or there is not God, and then we have also in religious communities undercutting the feature for beliefs that there is God, and we have undercutting the feature for belief that there is God, and it seems that we cannot have all these undercutting the features. I'm missing some point.
Well, yeah, I mean, so keep in mind that it's only you only have an undercutting defeater, and what that means is that you need a defeater. So, I mean, I take it that agnostics have a story to tell about why.
Yeah, but we are thinking only about beliefs from the community. We can fix the point that these are thoroughly SC-dependent beliefs.
As far as I just follow, it probably means, like, suppose you grew up in Scandinavia, your parents were atheists, your great-grandparents were atheists, and you just didn't even think that was a life option, so it's just purely lack of testimony or something.
Yeah, so it's just imagining a community of, like, atheists or something like that. Yeah, I'm fine with those being thoroughly SC-dependent, too. It's not like I have it in for the theist.
Yes.
Right. I mean, I don't have any axes to grind, like, to get at the theist today. I mean, if the atheist ends up in the same boat, that's fine with me.
Right.
But all
right.
I mean is, like, you, again, like, let's keep in mind what my takeaway point is. Like, you need a defeater, and I take it you talk to a lot of atheists; they've got a lot to say, as do theists. But
yeah.
I mean, like, my point is just that, you know.
But
yeah, I'm okay with that. I mean,
as do agnostics also.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if it's, you know, if again it's the same thing, yeah.
They say I love the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With that, let's thank us.